Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassāmi Tonight I'd like to offer some reflections on the Buddha's teaching on living in the present. One of the aims of Buddha's practice is to help us to live a more conscious and deliberate life. And central to this is being able to focus our attention in a relaxed and steady way on what is happening in our life in the present moment, in the here and now. Being able to pay attention to what we're doing, what we're thinking, and what we're feeling, and also to our reaction to what is happening to us in the present moment, so that we are able to discern whether the way that we are speaking or thinking or acting is for our own benefit, is skillful, and whether or not it's for the benefit of other people. And when we're able to discern that, then to choose how we're going to react, how we're going to speak, how we're going to behave, to transform how we are reacting. So being in the present moment isn't just about paying attention, but it's also about being aware of what is happening with insight. And the degree of control that we have over our life, especially over our inner life, but over our life, will depend on how much mindfulness and wisdom we're able to bring to each moment of our day. What stops us from being awake to our life, to living fully in the present moment, is the mind's tendency to want to go off to the past, to memories, happy or sad, to get lost in thoughts about the future, maybe hopes and dreams, or maybe fears and anxieties about what's coming, and also to get lost in the distractions of the present moment, so that we don't really know clearly what's happening in our life. And all of you would have probably experienced just this in the meditation. We want to keep our attention in the present moment. We want to observe the breath or observe the body. But the tendency of the mind is to flit to the past, to the future. It's hard to keep it in the present moment. The Buddha recited a poem to his disciples, which he encouraged them to learn by heart and to use in their daily life to help them to focus their attention in the present moment. And part of the poem goes like this. One should not trace back the past, nor on the future build one's hopes. The past is just the left behind, the future the yet unreached. Rather, with insight, one should watch each mind moment as it arises now. To know and to be sure of that today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? This poem is a summary of the Buddha's teaching on living in the present moment. And so we need to consider what the Buddha was talking about when he said, one should not trace back the past. The past is just the left behind. All of us have the tendency to drift back into the past. That's what we know of life so far, and it makes interesting reading when we're the star character. And so an old song can take us back years, or the smell of a fragrance that we associate with a particular person, or we drive through an area of the city that's changed now, but we remember how it used to be in the good old days. This is a natural tendency of the mind. And this isn't exactly what the Buddha was saying when he said that we shouldn't trace back the past. What he was meaning when he talked about tracing back the past is the tendency of once something arises in the mind as a memory, that instead of just acknowledging it as a memory, that we try to recapture that experience. We want to dwell in the past. And so instead of it just being a thought that arises and passes away, particularly if it's brought with it a pleasant feeling, we want to try to make that pleasant feeling last a little bit longer. And so we play around with that thought. We make it grow. We remember in detail what it was that was associated with that particular thing. Sometimes not even pleasant, sometimes even unpleasant. Something that's been a very important or significant event in our life. And so we identify with it. We get lost in it. We identify either our mind or our body with that experience. We identify our body. Gosh, you should have seen me 20 years ago. I really was fit, or I really had the energy, or boy, I could really get through things. Or we might think, oh gosh, years ago I seemed to be so much happier than I am now. I really knew about life. I really understood things. And so that thought of how it used to be drags us back into the past. And of course, when we remember things, that memory is always distorted. It's always filtered. And so how we remember something is never how it actually was. But very often we forget that. And when we look back, we forget that this is the present and that is the past. That can never be recaptured. That past has died. What we have now is a memory, a filtered memory of it. That's not to say that it can't be useful sometimes to revisit the past, because very often with greater life experience, with some emotional distance from an event, we can look back on it. We can see it differently. We can learn from it. For example, if we have a memory that our parents didn't do the right thing by us when we were young, they were too hard, or they were too mean, or they were too something. When we have the experience of being parents ourselves, we know how difficult it is to be the perfect parent. And so it may not change the things that happened in the past, but we have greater understanding and maybe compassion for the difficulties that our parents went through. And we're able to see it in quite a different light now that we've got more experience ourselves. And also, if we are able to revisit the past with conscious awareness, it can actually help us to bring forth positive mental states in the present. So, for example, the Buddha encouraged us to remember our acts of generosity, to remember those times when we've kept the precepts with difficulty, or when we've done any kind of action that's been helpful and kind. He said we should remember those and make them grow. And this understanding is actually one of the techniques that sports psychologists use with people who are about to participate in events. especially at a high level, some very successful athletes or team players have used this technique of going back to a happy time in their experience and going through in detail what happened to them at that time and generating the feeling of happiness and joy, maybe exhilaration, that went with that experience, because they know that they're going to perform at a much better level if they are in a happy state of mind. Happiness is an energizing quality. And so in this way, we can skillfully use a visit to the past to help us to generate happiness in the present. But we can only do that when we've got our feet on the ground in the present moment, when we understand this is what we're doing and we're doing it deliberately. If we fail to be able to make this distinction, if we continue to go back to the past, hoping to revive it, hoping to make it be in the present as it was, then we're bound to be disappointed. I met someone recently who said to me that 30 years ago life was great, people were really nice, but these days people are terrible and she's just waiting to die because she can't stand life anymore, she can't stand people. And in this situation it was interesting because the people who had brought her to visit and who were with her were obviously very nice people and very concerned with her. And yet her attachment to the way things used to be 30 years ago was making her blind to the nice people that she was with right now. And the other interesting thing she said was that actually when she thought about it, she was full of ill will herself. She had a lot of grudges that she was bearing in her own heart, and that was making her life more miserable. So if she was able to come into the present and experience herself, then she could contribute towards making people in the world much nicer and more pleasant by working on her own heart. She could be one of these nicer people instead of one of these miserable people full of ill will. And this is a good example of what happens to us when we continue to dwell in the past and wish that things today were like they used to be. We actually lose contact with the present moment. We actually die to life right now. We don't appreciate what we have, and we also don't see what we can do in the present moment to deal more skillfully with our situation. So this is one of the ways that we can get lost. And this is what the Buddha meant when he said we shouldn't trace back the past. When we go back to the past in this way and think about how it was 30 years ago, we're identifying with that as being me, as being real, as being something that belongs to me. But obviously, that's all changed. Nothing there from the past is as it was then. We're not the same. Life isn't the same. And it's learning to accept that and work with it that brings peace. Not that we can change that particular aspect of reality. So that's the past. And what about the future? The past, one should not trace back the past, nor on the future build one's hopes. The past is just the left behind, the future the yet unreached. And as I said earlier, sometimes the future holds great promise for people. They're full of hopes and dreams for how it's going to be. Or they're full of fears and anxieties about how it's going to be. And this was very evident at the way people were relating to the 2000 changeover, the date of moving from 1999 to 2000 for some people was momentous. It was going to produce the Age of Enlightenment. It was going to bring wonderful things to the whole of the world. And for other people, it was doom. It was going to mean the end of the world. It was going to mean great difficulties. And as you can see, here we are, a few weeks into the 2000s, and life goes on, one breath after the other, one day after the other. And this is very typical of life. And what happens when we get lost in the future is that we invest tremendous energy in hypothesizing, in scheming and anticipating something that we actually have no control over. There's no guarantee how it's going to be. And if we invest tremendous energy in working about what the future is going to be, again, we miss out on what's happening right now. What can we do in the present moment to produce the next mind moment of happiness, the next helpfulness, the next kindness, the next wisdom? We actually bypass that completely by racing off to the future. One time the Dalai Lama was in a conference with many learned scientists, and they were discussing what the future holds for mankind. And after everyone had given their talks over a number of days, in the final session where people were summing up what they projected into the future was going to happen for mankind in terms of technology and the effect on social relationships and all that sort of thing, all these learned scientists gave very lengthy expositions of their predictions for the future. And when it came to the Dalai Lama's turn to talk, he said simply, "I don't even know what kind of tea I'm going to have this afternoon at tea time. How can I possibly know what it's going to be like in the 20th century? It's a complete unknown." And so this is maybe an extreme view, but we can see how unpredictable life is when we just consider how the end of the 20th century turned out. Who could have predicted the collapse of communism, for example? Who would have known these things were coming? Now, this doesn't mean that in Buddhism we put our head in the sand and we don't think about the future, or we don't plan for the future. We all have to plan to a certain extent, but we do it without being attached to how those plans are going to turn out. So this is what the Buddha was saying, that we shouldn't put our hopes in the future. When the mind moves to the future, if it's necessary, we think about it. But once we've thought about it, once we've made a plan, we don't keep going back to it. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if this doesn't happen? Playing around with it with the assumption that we're going to be able to change it just by fiddling with it in our mind. Again, we invest tremendous energy in doing this, and we fail to see how we can help the future to be better by making the present better. And this is one of the important teachings, which is actually at the heart of this whole teaching on being in the present, living in the present moment. That in fact, the past and the future lie in the present. And we have to take care of the present in order to take care of the future. Now, the Buddha said that rather with insight, one should watch each mind moment as it arises now. And it's important for us to see, it's not just paying attention, knowing where our foot is going or where our hand is going or what's coming up. We have to observe with insight what is arising in the present moment. And in order to observe with insight, we need to understand how the mind works and how the past is already present in the present moment, even when we're not aware of it. And that the practice is gradually to become consciously aware of how the past is already in the present, and that we are creating the future right now by the seeds that we lay down. So in order to understand the effect of the past, as I said, we need to understand the way that the mind makes sense of information, the way that it processes what it experiences. And the Buddha's teaching and the Buddha's explanation of the way this happens in modern times has been substantiated and supported by psychology, by the discoveries that neuropsychologists and psychologists who specialize in understanding the way that the mind works, the way that the mind processes information, have actually discovered the same truths which the Buddha discovered through his own experience 2,500 years ago. What the psychologists have discovered is that when we process information in the present moment, that we always process that information in terms of our previous experience and prior knowledge. And the psychologists have called this our mindsets. Mindsets are our shortcut way of dealing with all of the information that we have to deal with through the senses. So first of all, we have to understand that the whole of the world as we know it is made up of our contacts through the senses, through what we see, through what we hear, through what we taste, through what we smell, through what we touch, and what we come in contact with through the body is touch, and what we think about. A person who's blind from birth has no experience of the colour white. And if you try to explain to them what is white, they can't conceive of it because that is not part of their world. Like taste, if you try to explain to someone what a mango tastes like, it's like this, it's like that, but until you taste the mango yourself, you don't know what a mango tastes like. So the whole of our world consists of what we experience through sense contact. The Buddha understood that the sense bases, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, these bases are only the doorways through which we receive information. But they're not what makes sense of that information. In order for us to see an object, the eye has to be working, the physical eye. There has to be a form within view. There has to be sufficient light. And then the mind also has to be actively engaged. If the mind isn't paying attention, even if something comes in to the range of our vision and there's sufficient light to see it, we won't see it. So, for example, if we're daydreaming, lost in thought, and someone walks past or someone calls our name, we won't know that unless the mind goes to that contact and pays attention. So when we are making sense of the world that we come in contact with, it's the mind that makes sense, not the eye, not the nose, not the tongue, not the ear. And the mind makes sense of things in terms of what it knows about those things already. This is the mindsets described by the psychologists. Mindsets, the psychologists say, have been developed as a tool for survival, so that when we come in contact with something, we can immediately make a decision whether it's something that we need for our survival, that's good for us, or something that has the potential to harm us. And over time, we all of us develop a whole range of mindsets. And we use these mindsets to recognize objects, to make sense of ideas. And what the psychologists have pointed out is that it depends on our mindsets how able we are to make sense of what we experience. For example, one of the things that they show is a picture, one of those pictures that if you look at it one way, you can see a rabbit, and if you look at it another way, you can see a duck. Now, what they point out is that if you've had experience of rabbits previously, when you look at that picture, you'll be able to pick out the rabbit. If you've had experience of ducks previously, when you look at the picture, you'll be able to pick out a duck. If you've had experience of rabbits and ducks previously, when you look at the picture, you'll be able to see a rabbit and a duck. And if you haven't ever come across a rabbit or a duck previously, when you look at that picture, all you'll see is a jumble of lines. It depends on your previous experience with that object. And if you consider how that applies in our life, when we come in contact with something that we're not familiar with, sometimes we're very puzzled and we try to make sense of it in terms of what we know. So an example that occurred for me was that some years ago when I was living in Sri Lanka and I came back to Australia for a visit, someone gave me a clock radio. And I didn't have any use for a clock radio. I didn't live where there was electricity. But I thought that that this would be something that was a nice gift to take back to give to one of my supporters because they had electricity. And in Sri Lanka, early in the morning at 4 o'clock, when you turn the radio on, the first thing that comes on is Paritta chanting and taking refuge and precepts. So it's a very nice thing to have a clock radio that you can set to turn on and wake you up when the Paritta chanting is on. So I took it back to Sri Lanka and I gave it to a friend who had been in Australia as a student and spoke English very well. And I also had the instructions for how to set it up. But because it didn't have the right electrical connections, I couldn't actually set it up and tune it in myself. So a couple of weeks later, I saw this person and I said to her, "Oh, how did you like the clock radio? Did you enjoy waking up to the Paritta chanting in the morning?" And she said to me, "Well, sister, I couldn't find where to put the tape in." Her only experience of electrical gadgets like this was tape recorders. And she couldn't conceive of this clock radio actually working without having to put something in there to produce what you wanted. But this is a familiar experience for all of us. If you go into an electronics shop and look at the new gadgets there, you don't know what half of them are. And if you look at the CD player that's the latest thing, you might have no idea how to even open it up to find out where you put the CD in. And so this is a typical experience that happens to us all the time. And not only that, when the mind sees something that it's familiar with, very often it sees it in terms of what it expects to see. So, for example, if you go and buy some crockery, just as an example, and you look at the cups, and there's a set of cups there, and they all look okay until you get them home, and then you discover that there's a crack or a chip, which you didn't see when you were looking at them in the shop. Because what you were expecting to see was a complete cup, a whole cup. So the mind actually makes things the way we expect them to be, how we assume they're going to be. And it's not until we pay particular attention to an object that we actually discern its particular quality or characteristics. Now, in the realm of ideas, the same thing applies. All of us, when we face a situation, assume that we're seeing it in the same way that everyone else is seeing it. And very often we can't understand why they don't see it the way we do, or we're even surprised that that's what's happening. So here's an example that the psychologists give for helping us to understand how even in the realm of ideas, we always relate to things in terms of our previous experience. And some of you may be familiar with this story, so don't give the answer if you do know. A father and son are driving along one day and they have a serious car accident. And both of them are taken to hospital and both of them require surgery. The boy is put onto the trolley and wheeled in to the operating theatre. And when the surgeon walks in to begin the operation, the surgeon looks at the boy and says, "I can't operate. This is my son." Who's the surgeon? Anyone who hasn't heard it before know the answer? Right, that's a good guess. It's not right though. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. Sorry? The mother, that's right. The surgeon is the boy's mother. We're so used to thinking in terms of surgeons being men. Of course, we know that there are lots of female doctors and that there are lots of female doctors who are surgeons. And interestingly enough, when people hear this question, they come up with all sorts of ideas. It's the grandfather, it's the stepfather, it's the father from a previous birth. Someone who came to the nun's monastery when I told this story is a Catholic, and she thought it might be the Holy Father. Of course, it's the mother. But if I had said to you that the boy is wheeled into the operating theatre and the nurse who's coming to assist in the operation looks at the boy and says, "I can't help in this operation, this is my son," most people would immediately say, "Oh, the nurse, it must be the boy's mother." We are trying to interpret experience in terms of what we know. And we're not even aware that that's what we're doing. And we wonder why we're trying to put square pegs in round holes, and why even in a group that's as close as a family, everyone is seeing things from a different perspective. Very often we're not even aware that we're seeing things from a different perspective until we compare notes. So it happens in families, it happens in workplaces, it happens all the time in many, many situations. Now, this is what the psychologists have been able to understand, and this is also what the Buddha understood through his own wisdom. But the Buddha took it one step further. He realised that it's not only the recognition of objects and not only the understanding of ideas that are based on our past experience, but it's also our emotional reaction in the present moment that is conditioned by the kind of experience that we've had with that same situation or that same person or one like it previously. And so very often we find that even in a situation where it's quite different from our emotional reaction, the facts of the situation, if you like, point to one thing. Our experience of it is quite different because of our emotional conditioning. So, for example, one experience that I can relate personally was Christmas time. Christmas time is in Australia, whether you're a Buddhist or Christian or whatever, is traditionally a time when families get together. Even if you don't celebrate in a religious sense, it's the time that people make the attempt to get back home and be with those that are near and dear to them. So in our family, a few years ago, when I was a lay person, Christmas Eve was coming. People were getting back to be in the family. And my aunt was travelling on a bus, bringing all the presents for the grandchildren. And that bus was involved in a very well-known accident, and she was killed. And her son, who happened to be a policeman, was called to the scene of the accident and discovered his mother dead on the bus. And a few years after that, only a couple of years after that, a cousin who was a long-distance truck driver was also making the effort to get back home in time for Christmas, just the week before Christmas, and he had an accident. His lorry caught fire and he was killed. So in the family, the idea of Christmas and family getting back together again always has quite a different connotation. People might say, well, isn't it great that people are coming back together. Isn't it great that we're all coming together for Christmas? Why are you so miserable? Christmas is a happy time. Why are you miserable at Christmas time? And obviously, from point of view of this is the way life is, one can say, oh yes, it is good that people come back together for Christmas. And one doesn't want to make other people miserable because this family's experienced difficulties. But it's also obvious to see the emotional overtone of Christmas and families, people making the effort to come back together, is quite different for a family who've experienced that kind of situation. And all of us will have those kinds of experiences in our life, which we can see very much colour how we relate to what we are experiencing in the present moment. All of this points to the fact that the past is very much alive in the present. And it's not something that we can block out. The way that our experience of the present happens is that our initial non-verbal reaction to it, which the Buddha called Vedana, is always conditioned by our past experience with that kind of thing, that kind of person, a similar situation. So the practice is to be able to recognize that and to understand how it's going to colour our reaction in the present moment. It's not possible to change that. What we have to do is to recognize it, sometimes bear with it if it's unpleasant, sometimes refrain from acting on it, restrain ourselves, and then at that moment choose what is the most appropriate, what is the most skillful, what is the most helpful way of acting in the present moment. Not being driven by our past experiences to respond habitually in the present moment in the same way that we always have. We might be looking at reactions of delight, of wanting things to be the way that they were, the past. We might be looking at reactions of anxiety, worrying about how the future's going to be. But we can't do anything about either of those unless we are consciously aware in the present moment that this is the process that is taking place. It's only in the present moment that we can deal with these things. Even a memory is still arising in the present moment. Thoughts about the future are arising in the present moment, and their reality is only of that mind moment arising now in the present moment. And this mind moment in the present is just like the ones of the past. It's impermanent. It arises dependent on conditions. Doesn't stand freely on its own, doesn't exist without the support of supporting factors, and it will also change and pass away. And so when the Buddha said that we need to look with insight at the present moment, it means that we also need to recognize the present moment as it is just like the past. Impermanent, conditioned, not self. How much control did we have over the past? If that was really me in the past, if that was my experience, where's it gone? Why can't I have it again? Why can't I make it stay? The experience in the future, I want it to be this way. How much control have I got over that? How much do I own it? Is it in my power to have it the way I want it to be? We relate both the past and the future to the present, and we see that the present also is in this same process, subject to these same conditions. And so the key to living at peace and with freedom in the present moment is also not to identify with this experience as absolute, fixed, not as mine, not that it's going to last forever, therefore not to be attached to it. Experience is just as fleeting, just as insubstantial, then we can allow it to move through us, if you like. The Buddha's saying there's no us anyway. So what we're doing is we're experiencing one mind moment after the other. We're trying to direct it in the way of wholesomeness. This is where our sila is important, keeping precepts, trying to cultivate wholesome qualities like loving kindness and generosity. This is what helps us in the present moment to make the choice towards wholesomeness. The Buddha said this is making the choice towards happiness. This is where we need to have mindfulness and wisdom operating in the present moment, to be aware of our experience as it arises, to know its true nature, and also to know how to transform our suffering into happiness. For this we need to be aware, we need to acknowledge, recognize the process that we're part of, we need to be able to bear with the unpleasantness that may arise with that. The painful memory comes with an unpleasant feeling. The happy memory comes with a pleasant feeling, but both of them are impermanent, insubstantial. And if I try to hang on to them, suffering will arise. If I try to perpetuate them, suffering will arise. So in that moment, we refrain. We choose what is wholesome, and we transform our suffering into happiness. This is the Buddha's way of living in the present moment. It's a very active practice. It's not about letting life slide by. It's about being awake to our life fully, and to understand that the only moment that we have any control over is the present moment. If we don't live awake to the present moment, then we're losing our life. No matter what we anticipate that it might be in the future, we're losing our life when we don't pay attention to the present moment. And just to finish, I'd just like to read a slightly different version of the poem. This is the first version that I quoted is from the Pali Canon. And this version is the same poem with slightly a few different words, and perhaps may help you to relate to it with some depth. Do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is, and the future has not yet come. Looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must be diligent today. To wait until tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. So I offer those words for your reflection tonight, and if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them, or comments. Yes? It certainly can be. The question is the pain of the past a spur to your practice? And it certainly can be. And that's one of the wonderful things about the Buddha's teaching, that he's not only explaining how these things work, he's also explaining how we can transform our pain and use it as something to spur us on, and by understanding it, by being able to see it in its proper perspective, we can then work with it skillfully in the present moment. So if the first step always is to acknowledge that suffering is present, and it doesn't have to be I am suffering or this is my suffering, just to acknowledge that suffering is present is aligning our life or our wisdom with the first noble truth, and that's a very good starting point. Roland, you had a question? Yes. Now, the planning for the future is very important, but what we do is that we plan and then we get attached to our plan. We delight in it. We hope that it's going to be that way. If it doesn't turn out that way, we're going to be disappointed. We don't put the plan down. It's like when we have something stuck in our tooth and we keep our tongue keeps going back to that place all the time. We can't let it go. We can't get it out and we can't shift it, but we keep going back there and fiddling with it. And this is what the Buddha was saying is not skillful. We certainly have to plan, and when we make those plans, we do the best we can, but then we put them down. If it's appropriate to change them, then we change them. But we don't look to the future with delight or with attachment to that these things have to turn out the way I want them to be or I'm going to be devastated. Because there are so many jokers in the pack of life. We just, you know, we can never know if it's definitely going to turn out. I have to practice this continually in my anticipation for how the nuns' monastery is going to turn out. And I can see how easy it is to lose the pleasure of the present moment by worrying about how it's going to be in the future. It's a constant practice for me to keep coming back to, well, this is how it is now, and who knows how it's going to be in a year's time. Don't have to plan and have to work and have an idea of how it's going to be, but it's still unpredictable. I could be dead tomorrow. So, you know, I'm worrying about what's going to happen next year and I'm not even going to be here to face it, so let me enjoy now. So if there are no other questions, then James, would you like to come and make some announcements?